Have you ever wondered why some of the world's wealthiest entrepreneurs live like monks? Why billionaires sleep on office couches and eat the same meal every day? The answer lies in a religious revolution that happened 5 centuries ago, one that accidentally invented modern capitalism. Max Weber's groundbreaking analysis reveals something startling. The psychological machinery of capitalism wasn't designed by economists or merchants. It was forged in the fires of Protestant theology. This isn't just historical curiosity. Understanding this connection illuminates why we work the way we do, why guilt shadows our leisure time, and why hustle culture feels oddly religious even when we're not. Across 19th century Europe, a peculiar pattern emerged. In regions where Catholics and Protestants lived side by side, Protestants consistently dominated business ownership, technical education, and capital accumulation. This wasn't marginal, it was overwhelming. The conventional wisdom suggested Protestants were simply rebelling against traditional authority. But Weber noticed something stranger. The most devout Protestants often showed the strongest business instincts. Pietistic communities became industrial powerhouses. This presented a genuine puzzle. Medieval Christianity had treated profit-seeking with deep suspicion, viewing merchants as spiritually compromised. Thomas Aquinas argued for just prices that barely covered costs. Dying merchants regularly returned ill-gotten gains to ease their consciences. How did Christianity transform from condemning profit to celebrating it as holy work? The answer wasn't that Protestants were less religious. They were differently religious in ways that accidentally created capitalism's psychological foundation. The Reformation demolished Christianity's two-tiered moral system. For centuries, the truly devout pursued spiritual perfection through monastic withdrawal, while ordinary people followed relaxed moral codes acknowledging human weakness. Martin Luther introduced something revolutionary, the concept of calling, Beruf. Through his Bible translation, everyday occupations gained spiritual significance previously reserved for priests and monks. A cobbler's work could be as holy as a cardinal's prayers. This linguistic shift reflected a theological earthquake. Your job wasn't just how you survived, it was how you served God. Yet Luther's vision remained fundamentally conservative. After the traumatic peasant uprisings of 1524, he increasingly emphasized accepting your station in life as divinely ordained. Work gained spiritual dignity, but transformation remained suspect. This explains why Lutheran regions often showed less economic dynamism than their Calvinist neighbors. Luther opened the door but couldn't walk through it. That required a more radical theology. John Calvin's doctrine of predestination created a psychological crisis that inadvertently fueled capitalism. Imagine believing God predetermined your eternal fate before you were born, and nothing you do can change it. You can't earn salvation through good works or sacraments. The question becomes unbearable. Am I among the elect or the damned? This anxiety produced a counterintuitive response. Rather than fatalism, it generated an overwhelming need for assurance. Since salvation should produce good works as evidence, success in your calling became a crucial sign of election. Calvinism demanded not single good works, but a life of good works combined into a unified system. Puritans monitored their spiritual state through moral account books, Benjamin Franklin's virtue tables being a famous example. This created something unprecedented, a spiritual aristocracy of saints within the world, separated from the damned by an impassable gulf, yet working within everyday occupations. The systematic quality of this ethical conduct distinguished Calvinism from Lutheranism. While Luther emphasized freedom through grace, Calvinism demanded constant self-control and methodical life regulation. This difference was visible in contrasting moral standards between Reformed and Lutheran communities. The latter lacked the psychological machinery for systematic rationalization of life that made Calvinism such a powerful economic force. Protestant asceticism redirected monastic discipline from cloisters into everyday life. Ordinary believers were expected to demonstrate the same rigor within their worldly occupations, what Weber called innerworldly asceticism. Richard Baxter, the influential Puritan minister, warned that wasting time in vain recreation, dressings, feastings, idle talk, was robbing God of labor owed to him. Time itself became sacred. Be every day more careful that you lose none of your time than you are that you lose none of your gold and silver. Even wealthy Quakers required their sons to learn trades as ethical imperatives, not utilitarian necessities. This created a fascinating economic paradox. By condemning wealth's enjoyment while sanctifying its production, Protestantism created perfect conditions for capital accumulation. The Puritan could spend reluctantly on personal needs while reinvesting business profits. Everything spent for personal ends was withdrawn from God's service. This ascetic consumption, combined with religious obligation to work, generated unprecedented capital accumulation, visible in colonial America, where the Puritan North always had capital available for investment, creating striking contrast with the South. Benjamin Franklin's maxims, time is money, credit is money, capture what Weber calls the spirit of capitalism. These principles embody an ethic, a duty toward accumulating capital as an end in itself. This differs fundamentally from traditional attitudes. The medieval craftsman worked to maintain his living standard and stopped when needs were met. The capitalist accumulates capital divorced from personal enjoyment, an approach completely devoid of any eudaimonistic admixture, and transcendental and absolutely irrational from a happiness perspective. Consider the entrepreneur working 80-hour weeks while living modestly, reinvesting every profit. This behavior makes no sense for personal happiness, only as a calling. By Franklin's time, this ethic had lost its religious foundations, but its psychological force remained. What began as religious conviction became economic necessity. Modern capitalism created an immense cosmos, forcing conformity or market elimination. The light cloak of material concern, Puritan theologians described, became an iron cage, rigid and inescapable. With religious meaning stripped away, wealth pursuit becomes associated with purely mundane passions, resembling sport. We risk becoming specialists without spirit, sensualists without heart, imagining unprecedented civilization while losing the moral purpose that gave economic activity meaning. Weber reveals a striking irony. Religious movements most opposed to materialism inadvertently created conditions for unprecedented prosperity. Ascetic Protestants who viewed wealth as dangerous temptation established the psychological foundations for its systematic accumulation. This legacy persists today. Protestant-majority countries show stronger property rights, lower corruption, and higher institutional trust, crucial market economy foundations. The Protestant work ethic remains recognizable even in secular societies. We valorize hard work, morally approve wealth from disciplined effort, and suspect idle consumption, attitudes rooted in forgotten religious convictions. Understanding these roots illuminates modern capitalism's moral ambiguities. We've inherited an economic system generating unprecedented prosperity while lacking the spiritual purpose that originally animated it. The challenge isn't returning to old religious frameworks, but recovering purpose that gives meaning to economic activity beyond mere accumulation. In our world where productivity apps replace prayer books and hustle culture echoes Puritan devotion, we're still living in capitalism's shadow, working in callings we no longer recognize as sacred, accumulating capital toward ends we've forgotten how to name. Weber's question remains urgent. Can we reclaim meaning in our work without the religious framework that first gave it purpose? Or are we trapped in the iron cage, going through motions whose significance we've lost?